It is Mason in Ireland. Today it's Momo in Ireland, and we wind into the final hour of the show. In this hour, Bruce Feldman expected to join us. We've also got Game of Games, and we want to start this hour by talking about the fact that the Dodgers now, Ramona, have finally started to talk. It's weird because there's this Justin Turner cloud hanging over their World Series victory, their first World Series in 32 years. But they're starting to do interviews. They don't do a lot when they're asked about Turner. Here's an example. Last night, both Cody Bellinger and Clayton Kershaw were on Jimmy Kimmel, and Jimmy asked them about Turner. Here's how it sounded.
Speaking of the bubble, did everyone stay away from Justin Turner during the party after the game? So like, get away from me, you with that.
Oh, man.
No, we didn't know.
We really didn't even know what was going on.
Oh,
I found out in the ninth inning. And then Mookie hit the homer right after I found out. And then it was pure just, all right, let's close this game out, win a championship. And it was a crazy time.
And Ramona, I don't think the questions about Justin Turner will stop until Justin Turner says something.
No, I mean, look, there's a news cycle that's going to change because it's a Friday and, you know, we'll change the page, right? We'll get into a college football weekend. We got Big Ten football now. There's, you know, Trevor Lawrence, as we're going to talk about pretty soon, with Bruce Feldman coming up. Like, he has COVID, and so he's going to miss the game this weekend. There's NFL. So the Dodgers will recede from view. But you know what's sad about this? They shouldn't. They just won the World Series, and it sucks that his teammates are having to answer, and this is any kind of a cloud over their World Series win. Like, Justin Turner is, like, the heart and soul of that team. He should be nothing but celebrated for his contributions. He made a mistake by going back out onto the field. Just say I made a mistake, and everybody can move on. Not that hard.
Yeah, here's Corey Seager. He was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. He was asked about winning the World Series.
I don't even know what to say. It was awesome. Yeah, it really was. What we did this year, how we did it, you know, making it through, getting down early in the CS, and then finally being able to pull out the last win, the last out, and be able to celebrate with LA, man. It's special.
Dave Roberts came on yesterday with Sedano and LZ, did an exclusive interview in the 5 o'clock hour. I would encourage you to go back and listen to the whole thing. But, one of the things he talked about was when they lost game four, Ramona, that was gut-wrenching. Mm-hmm. They had that game. They made those two screw-ups at the end of it, and it ended up costing them the game, and it tied the series. Here's Dave Roberts talking about how they overcame the loss in game four.
It was a tough loss, and you could see my emotions at the end where I was thinking, I see a Rose Reina fall down, and I thought I was thinking about the next inning, and next thing I know, the ball gets by Will Smith, and we get walked off. So our players, it was just no surprise that we could come out the next day and be ready to win a baseball game, and it's just the most resilient, and I know people say that quite often, but we don't make excuses. We play every pitch, and there was a thing that we had on the board that I wanted up there was, you know, the team that eliminates the scoreboard and plays every pitch is going to win tonight's game. You know, and I just think that in a game like that, you're back against the wall. You can't worry about, you got to play every pitch. You can't, because once you start thinking about the inning, the situation, that's where pressure and stress start to be introduced. So our guys did a tremendous job of that.
And Ramona, I remember Mike Socha telling me the same thing. Like, when he would get up 1-0 in the World Series or 2-0 in the World Series, the situation then is, like, Socha, they used to say, well, do you have an advantage being up 2-0? He goes, I don't even talk about the fact that we're up 2-0. I let you guys, we just play each game individually as hard as we can, and we let you guys add them up at the end. That's a hard thing to do, to not look at the score and not look at the scoreboard. But I think most coaches and managers actually try and get their teams to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you can create realities that are not there. You can, like, this idea that there's more pressure. No, the truth is, every single pitch, every single out is all the same. It's like you know, the idea that you're, there's more pressure on you when you're down. Not really. I mean, it should be independent. It should be, these are all separate independent events. And I think the Dodgers did a really good job of that. Well, and I think it helped that they had to sort of face elimination so many times in that Braves series, because they learned how to play with that. But what to me, the biggest difference that the Dodgers did this year was they stopped trying to jack balls out of the yard. They got back to scoring the old-fashioned way, manufacturing some runs. That's like Mookie Betts with his stolen bases, or situational hitting. Austin Barnes was great at that. Mookie was great at that. I thought Muncy drew a lot of really big walks. I mean, just stuff like that, old-school baseball, where it wasn't just sitting back and hoping that somebody hit a three-run homer. And right. And to me, that's everything when you get down to it in the World Series.
You mentioned Mookie Betts. Here's Dave Roberts talking about the impact that Betts had on the Dodgers this year.
Well, now we have a guy that really plays every single play and minds the little things. It just really resonated with our team even more. So when you can go into the postseason and say, a walk's as good as a hit, take good at bats, don't swing for the fences. When a coach is saying that, that's one thing. But when you're a superstar player saying that and guys have respect for him, it really just kind of translates to the field. In the clubhouse, in the dugout, Mookie's kind of talking to everybody about, you know, competitive advantages or edges and what we can do on the margins to win. And, you know, you guys saw it on the bases and on contact plays. He scores two big runs for us, and defensively, just a lot of different things that he's really done. And for me, he was a difference with our ball club.
And so now, Ramona, we turn the page. And by the way, you're listening to KSPN Los Angeles. Seven guys who were on this team this year are now officially free agents now that the World Series is over. I'll throw a name at you. You tell me likely to stay
back
or likely to go. Okay, and I'm going to start with the biggest name, Justin Turner.
If they keep the DH for next year, then I say yes.
I think it's yes, even if they don't keep the DH.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that he's meant too much to the team. He was too valuable in the playoffs. I think they work out at least a short-term contract for Turner. I would be very surprised if he left. Now, the next name, I would not be surprised if he left at all. Jock Peterson. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think he goes. I mean, they already tried
I think
to
someone
him.
Else is going to pay him way more than the Dodgers are willing to pay him, don't you?
Yeah, I think they'll pay him, and I don't think the Dodgers would pay him. I think they would, you know, just do a one-year deal with him. And like, the thing with Jock, what's amazing is that I kept thinking to myself, like, Jock Peterson and Brusdar Graterol were not even supposed to be on the team. They were supposed to be traded in that Mookie Betts deal.
Right.
But that whole thing fell apart. They became, like, these key pieces for the Dodgers, you know, in the playoffs. And, like, Jock has I think he would benefit from a change of scenery. He doesn't do well in the regular season. He strikes out too much. As you know, he doesn't get on base. He loses focus sometimes. But I think some of that is also because he's perpetually in a platoon situation here. So if he's not hitting well, he doesn't get another at bat to work through it. Another place that's going to invest in him and give him money, but also like let him play every day, I think he'll do a lot better.
Jake McGee, he's a pitcher. I think he was somewhat inconsequential, so... wouldn't be surprised if he stayed or went.
Yeah.
What about Alex Wood?
Interesting. It's an interesting one. I don't think they'll pay that much to keep him. He isn't. They got a lot of young arms, so I don't think they want to invest there. If they're gonna do anything, it's gonna be to make a big splash with like a Trevor Bauer type.
Blake Treinen, who was very
good.
I thought.
Ooh, yeah, very good. I actually think he'll sign someplace else. Somebody else will pay him because the Dodgers have Graterol lined up to succeed as a closer. And they're, unless they can work out a trade for Kenley, they're already paying $15 million there.
Okay, two more. Pedro Baez.
Ooh. Oh, man. You should see my text chain of all my friends who are Dodger fans. Whenever Baez comes into the game, it's like, Baez! Oh, no.
Yeah, Bergman's like that. He melts down every damn bite.
You know what? He's not bad. He does do better than people give him credit for. It kind of depends on if anyone throws the money at him. I think they keep him.
And the last one, Kike Hernandez.
Oh,
what do you think?
Kills me. I think somebody's going to pay him.
Really?
don't you? He's a really valuable utility guy. He's been, I think the Dodgers will try to keep him, but if anybody throws money at him, I think they have to let him go because they've got Gavin Lux waiting in the wings. They've got, who's the guy who came in and played third at the end there?
Edwin Rios.
Rios, yeah. I mean, they've got guys who can do what Kike does, and he could command some money, and he probably wants to play every day.
And it'll be interesting to see if the Dodgers, they've got to coming up pretty soon. They got to make decisions on Kershaw. They got to make, right. We mentioned Justin Turner. There's a lot of rumors in the air that they may go trade for Francisco Lindor. And maybe move Corey Seager to third or let Seager walk since Seager is a Scott Boris client and Boris will probably take him to free agency. So it'll be very interesting to see. The Dodgers are already favored, Ramona, to win it next year in Las Vegas. So it'll be very interesting to see which guys they keep and which guys they try and let leave because they're defending a title as the favorite.
Yeah, I think this is now that they've won, there's like a there's a sentimental thing, like you want to keep your team together, but you still have to, but you want to be in position to win every year. And I think this team is built to where they can keep contending for 3 or 4 more years if they keep their core together. I think to me, of all the names you listed there, the most important name was Corey Seager. I think he's eligible for an extension pretty soon. They're going to have to think about paying him and paying Cody Bellinger pretty soon. That's a lot of money that they're going to be paying to Mookie and to Bellinger and to Seager. Does it come down to a choice between those two? Do you have to choose between Corey and Belly, or do you keep both? Those are big, big, big choices ahead.
All right, so the Dodgers have a lot of decisions to make in the coming days. The other big baseball story today, A.J. Hinch, the guy who managed the Astros when they beat the Dodgers for the World Series in 2017, was hired today by the Detroit Tigers to be their new manager. Hinch and the Astros GM, Jeff Luhnow, were fired back on January 13th. So, Ramona, he wasn't out of baseball for even a year. They suspended Hinch and Alex Cora, the Red Sox manager. There's a lot of talk that Cora might go back to the Red Sox and manage the Red Sox again, even though the suspensions only lasted about 10 months. So, was Hinch, and I guess we can throw Cora into this too, was his punishment too long, too short, or just enough?
You know, Hinch was the one guy I thought kind of took the fall for this when it wasn't really all on him. I mean, he knew it was going on. He didn't do enough to stop it, but he apologized. He said it was wrong. And I think he said I should have done more to stop it. You know, like I think I'm okay with him coming back after a year.
Do you think he can change his legacy, or will the cheating scandal always be in the first paragraph of any AJ Hinch story?
I think he changes it because I think this cheating scandal sticks more to the players than it does to him. I mean, to me, the face of that cheating scandal is Carlos Correa because he's the most defiant guy. He's it's Jose Altuve with the wire. On,
yeah.
Right. I mean, to me, it sticks to the players and they're the ones who didn't pay any punishment. They got immunity. So to me, Alex Cora, he seemed like be more the mastermind behind that. I have a little more of a problem with him coming back so soon because he seems like he was in charge. He was doing it. Like he was the guy behind it. AJ was just didn't do enough to stop it. So I think we need to see each of these people in their own individual light and not sort of convict them all together.
Yeah. I think that that story will still fall. Like every time I see AJ Hinch, the first thing I think of is cheater.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's going to be managing a different team. And maybe especially if they win a title in Detroit, it'll be an opportunity for him to change the narrative. Okay. So let's get to this Trevor Lawrence story because we've got Bruce Feldman coming up in a couple of minutes here. For those who haven't heard, Trevor Lawrence, one of college football's leading voices to play this season. He wanted to, he was adamant, let's play. Amid the ongoing pandemic, has tested positive for the coronavirus. Clemson announced it yesterday. Clemson's the number one ranked team in the country. It'll be without Lawrence for at least this weekend as he's forced to isolate for 10 days per ACC regulations. Depending on the date of his positive test, he's also in danger of missing the Tigers matchup with Notre Dame on November 7th, which is 9 days away. All right, so a couple things here, Ramona. If you're Trevor Lawrence, you're a lock to be the number one pick in the draft next year. Now you've got coronavirus, so you're probably not going to win the Heisman. Do you even go back and play this year at all? You don't need it. You're going to be the number one pick if you ever go back. Do you go back?
Yeah, I think I do. He wants to. I mean, he's the hashtag we want to play guy. You know, he didn't have to play at all this year. I just think he likes football. I think he wants to play. I mean, I'm sure he's taken out insurance. I'm sure whoever is advising him has done that. And, you know, there are those who, I don't know if he's symptomatic. Do we know?
He says he has minimal symptoms. That's what they announced in a statement.
So, you know, we'll see. Does he have, are those going to stay minimal? Is he going to get really sick? Like, I mean, we don't know yet. But if he has minimal symptoms and he's clear to play, I think you just come right on back as soon as you're able to. And then you think, if I'm an NFL team, I'm kind of like thinking about drafting him. I'm like, oh, good. He already had it? Good. Now he's got the antibodies, right?
Right.
I mean, there's this sense that Clemson was one of those teams that had a lot of positives early on. And it was just like, you know, remember we asked the question, are they doing the herd immunity thing? You know, I mean, it seems like they've had a lot of guys already had it. So it's less of a risk going forward. Once, if 70% of your team's had it, you're less likely to spread it between you at this point.
Right. Well, what will Lawrence do? Will he be on the field for Notre Dame? That's one of the things we will talk about with Bruce Feldman from The Athletic and Fox Sports. Bruce is the best college football writer I know. He also has a new book out about Ed Orgeron, which doesn't say many nice things about USC. We'll get into that with Bruce. He'll join us next.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Mason in Ireland, Ramona. Ramona Shelburne's in for Mace. And we're going to talk a little college football in this segment. You know, Ramona, I have to admit, I'm a huge college football fan. I have not watched a college football game start to finish since they came back. It's just weird to me. Half the conferences are playing. The other half aren't. And now we have a major story in that the overwhelming favorite to win the Heisman Trophy, Trevor Lawrence, the quarterback at Clemson, is out because of the coronavirus. Now, what's interesting here is that in the ACC, the conference where Clemson plays, you're required to sit out for 10 days. In the Big Ten, if Lawrence played in the Big Ten, he'd be required to sit out for 21 days because the rules are different in each conference. Doesn't that put a competitive disadvantage to the teams in the Big Ten?
Yeah, it does. But the thing is, there's no college football. There's no central authority on college football. It's just, it's kind of like states' rights, right? It's sort of like conference rights. Like, there's nobody regulating any of this. Like, they play, they don't play. It's 10 days. I mean, Nick Saban had a false positive or whatever it was, and he was right back on the sidelines, right? I mean, there's just nothing in college football that has any kind of authority.
Well, think about it. Today's the last day of October. Now, literally, every other year, we've seen 7 or 8 UCLA or USC games by now. We've seen 0. The Pac-12 has yet to play a game. And they're going to start in the coming month in November. So if a Pac-12 team gets hot and they go 6-0, 7-0, is that enough to get them in the playoff? Or if another team that's played 10 games is 9-1, would you rather take them? I mean, I just think there's so many questions. Yeah, and to help us answer those is our friend Bruce Feldman, who is the best college football guy I know. Bruce, thank you for doing this. And first, let me start with that Trevor Lawrence thing. If he played in the Big Ten, he'd have to sit out for 21 days. But in the ACC, he only has to sit out for 10. Do I have that right?
You do. And it's going to be interesting to find out when he actually first noticed symptoms. Because if he first noticed symptoms, even after sources tell us that he tested positive on Wednesday, but if he first noticed symptoms, let's say on Monday or Tuesday, that's when the 10-day period would start. And as long as he is asymptomatic on the last day, then he can return to competition from there.
Do we know?
So do they have like two negative tests or anything? Do they have to have like negative tests before they return? Like two negative tests,
yes, I mean,
you know, within a 48-hour period? Like, do they have anything like that?
Yeah, just like, you know, they're still going to be testing as they do regularly. So there would be an ACC test that they take, just like they're going to take Clemson has a BC game, a game against Boston College tomorrow. So they're taking a test today. Same thing. They will play at Notre Dame a week from tomorrow. So there would be that test as well. Then obviously that would have to come back negative. But this is different than the SEC rule where, you remember, Nick Saban had what apparently was a false positive. And then their test out policy was if you get three negative PCR tests in a row, all being 24 hours apart, then you're able to return to competition. So every league has somewhat different rules and guidelines, and that can make it quite confusing.
Bruce Feldman is joining us. Bruce, two other questions about Trevor Lawrence. One, he's the type of kid that probably, like, you might look at the situation and say, well, he caught coronavirus. He's going to be the number one pick in the draft. He is he's just not going to come back. He's just going to take time off and get ready for the draft. He's never indicated that, right? Most speculation is that when he's healthy, he'll definitely come back.
Yeah, and that's everything I've ever heard, that, you know, he was not opting out. I mean, remember, he was one of those players who was very vocal about get back everybody on board to play. I'm not saying he's motivated by the Heisman. He's obviously won one national title, but, you know, he knows Travis Etienne came back. They didn't like the way things ended last year by getting beat pretty soundly by LSU in the title game. So I think they, I think he knows he has a lot to play for. And, you know, assuming that he's back healthy again, Notre Dame looks to be the toughest opponent they have, at least in the regular season. And obviously that's in a road game as well.
Okay. The other question is, there was a story that was going around in your world that I think it was mostly media generated, that he would consider going back to Clemson for his senior year so he didn't have to play for the Jets, that the Jets are so bad and he's the type of kid that likes football that he might pull a Peyton Manning. Remember, Peyton went back to Tennessee for his senior year. Do you buy that? Do you buy that Trevor Lawrence is considering not putting his name in the draft at the end of this season?
I'm a little skeptical of that, John, just because lots of players say, yeah, I haven't decided, or they make hesitations. They don't want to put out any declarations about their intentions in October or even November. So, you know, yes, I feel like that's a heavy NFL media story, because it's like, ooh, the Jets are so bad, but I'm bummed, and Trevor Lawrence is gonna stay in school an extra year. I mean, he's already got insurance policies and everything else, but I'd be surprised if he opted to come back for another year, but I'd also be surprised if he wanted to actually engage in some big dialogue about it now, because I don't know what purpose that serves him.
Do we know are they going to disclose when he tested positive? Like, do they have to in order for him to come back? I know those are ACC rules, but it's also his information, right?
Yeah. I mean, from my reporting and from other people's reporting, it's been pretty clear that it was Wednesday, because that is one of the days, unlike the Pac-12 is going to do, unlike the Big Ten is doing, they're not testing daily. So that's in line with that. The question, Ramona, I think that's probably also relevant is, will they at some point, and this would certainly come from Trevor or Clemson officially, would they disclose when he first started feeling symptoms? Because again, that would start that 10-day period. Because I think one thing that was a little vague in some of the reporting in the last 24 hours was, according to the ACC guidelines, it was said that when you start feeling symptoms / when the positive test comes down, and speaking to somebody on the inside of this, they had explained it's actually when it first happens, then that's the thing that's more of the trigger on the timeline.
Right. Well, we're talking to Bruce Feldman, college football reporter, writer for The Athletic. You can see Bruce on Fox Sports. Ramona, I'm lucky because Bruce and I are neighbors. So a few days ago, he slipped me a copy of a new book. And Bruce,
nice.
It's a book written with Ed Orgeron called Flip the Script. Bruce, I know it was supposed to be available this week. Can people buy it today or is there still a couple more days before you can get it?
No, it came out on Tuesday. So this was the release week. So it's been cool. I've gotten a lot of feedback. Like, I was surprised how many football coaches have already read it. So I wouldn't have expected that.
Wow. But,
so the response
has been
good. Yes, and I knew it would get some traction out here just because he really was pretty candid on the way things kind of blew up at USC.
That's where I wanted to go. So, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about. In this book, he talks about the end at USC, and there was stuff. We were the USC station at that time, so we were pretty close to all that, Bruce. And there was stuff in here that I had never heard before, but I wanted for you to preview it for people who are interested in the book. He feels like he was not treated fairly, and would it be even fair to say he feels like he was lied to?
Yeah, I think more than, you know, whether, you know, I don't know if he would have said treated fairly per se, but I think he really feels like, you know, Pat Hayden was really misled him in the run up to, you got to remember, like at the end of the season, they have a big win over a top five Stanford team. He feels like at that point, even though there was a lot of things and people can read in the book, kind of the way Pat Hayden was kind of dangling the job, but also saying, hey, you know, you're not the head coach, you're just the interim guy, even as much as like, hey, I don't want you really moving into that Lane Kiffin's office. You just stay in the D-line office for now. And that was kind of how it was handled. And then so they get some momentum and everybody, it seems to be pulling for him, especially inside the program. And then it comes down to basically the Friday before the UCLA game, and Pat Hayden has a contract in front of him and basically said he was 99% sure that he was going to be the next head coach at USC. Then he said Hayden had the contract in his desk. He didn't sign it, but then he would go around introducing himself to people as, you know, Ed Orgeron's going to be the next head coach at USC. And he's like, I'm going to make it a formality and just make sure your wife stays over, because his wife was still living in Louisiana with the kids till Monday.
Wow.
He cut some suits. Then they lose to UCLA, and he goes, Hayden was supposed to call me on Sunday. He never did. And on top of that, he goes, I find out from somebody else that the guy they're hiring is Steve Sarkisian. Well, obviously, we all know how the Steve Sarkisian hire at USC worked. So I think, you know, it was pretty amazing to talk to, because there's quotes, like I've talked to Antoine Woods, who a lot of people remember is a really good D lineman there, about how that went down and what it was like in the meeting when Orgeron is telling the team, I'm not getting the job and everything else. And it was like Antoine Woods said, it was like somebody losing their parent, and just how devastating everybody was about seeing how it all went down like that.
It's Bruce. It is a really good read. The book is called Flip the Script. Bruce Feldman wrote this with Ed Orgeron, and you can buy it today. The other thing that I liked about it is what people forget how unlikely this undefeated LSU run was, because they play in the same conference as Alabama. You know, everybody just assumes that at the end, Alabama's going to be there. But this really was kind of a magic season. Do you think now, like you talk in the book about how USC alumni and outside kind of outside things pressured the Trojans into not giving Orgeron the job. Do you think they regret it now?
I think probably some people do. I think there's still a lot of people out there who go, you know what? He's the perfect fit at LSU.
Yeah, maybe.
He's different out here. And I think there's an element of like, he's just, I know he loved the program. I know he's a great recruiter. I know players liked him. I just think there's, for the vibe I get, and we both know a lot of USC people, and the vibe I get from a lot of them is they like him, they just don't necessarily see him as the head coach, which is kind of the way, to some degree, I think a lot of them look at Clay Helton as the same way. They like him. I don't think they think he should be the head coach. I mean, look, maybe they'll run the table this year, but I still feel like there's a perception thing that he's not going to get passed. And Ed Orgeron could have won a national title here, and maybe that would have changed things. But the thing that you know, has always struck me is even though he was really passed over and done that way by Pat Hayden, he has a reverence for USC that, you know, I know you remember hearing stories of like how Marv Gu had really imparted a lot of wisdom and how Pete and all these other guys have connected with him and how he feels about, you know, the Marcus Allens and the Ronnie Lott. Like, he still has a really special place in his heart, I know, for USC. So I think that part stung him more. But at the same time, you know, like, it's just a weird dynamic because here you have the guy who the practice field at USC is named for, Brian Kennedy, who's a big booster. Mm. And after everything went down with Ogeron and Pat Hayden, Brian Kennedy basically has walked away from the USC program and wants nothing to do with it. So there's a bunch of people who are just disgusted by how it went down with Pat Hayden. And I think that has left a bad taste in people's mouths. And obviously, you know, Sark's time there was a debacle. So that probably only made it worse. And, you know, look, Clay Helton's had some good years there. So especially when, you know, they went to the Rose Bowl. So I don't think this is necessarily just a Clay Helton thing. I think it's just another example of USC dysfunction, especially in the Hayden. And then later on, it certainly carried over to Lynn Swann era.
Well, the book is called Flip the Script. Go ahead, Ramona.
Hey, Bruce, if they win that UCLA game, does Ed keep his job? Is it as simple as that?
I think it would have been almost impossible, Ramona, for Pat Hayden not to hire him at that point. Because it's not like Steve Sarkisian was, you know, winning Pac-12 championships at that point. You know, it wasn't like he was a slam dunk, hey, we got to go get this guy. I think at that point it would have been impossible for them to say, hey, we're still going in a different direction. I think just the fact that it got to that point, I think Pat Hayden was really uncomfortable with. And Ogeron talks about some stuff in the book where he's like, this was really weird, him calling me on the day of the game and a conversation we had. And, you know, when he left there, he was devastated. And to the point where his wife basically was saying, look, God has a bigger plan for you. And he was kind of just so mortified by everything, the way it played down, he couldn't fathom it, when in reality it did work out that way, where, you know, as unbelievable as it was, he gets to be an interim head coach again for a second time, and this almost like it was with after Lane got fired, it was almost for a full season. So he gets to show that he is more than just the guy who got fired at Ole Miss years ago, and then he ends up coaching the school he dreamed of playing for to a national title. I mean, it's as improbable as you probably can get.
Bruce, thank you for doing this, man. It'll be an interesting weekend to see what happens. Just give me a quick thought on this. Trevor Lawrence, likely or unlikely to play in the Notre Dame game, in your opinion?
I will be surprised if he does not play in the Notre Dame game. Just on my guess and hunch right now for the way this thing is shaping up.
Okay. Thanks for this. The book is called Flip the Script. Bruce wrote it with Ed Orgeron. Bruce, good luck this weekend. We'll talk again soon.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
There is Bruce Feldman. And when we come back, when's the NBA going to start? Is it Christmas? Is it Martin Luther King Day? When is it? We'll get into that next. Still got to play Game of Games before the end of the hour. Ramona in for Mace. Mason in Ireland, ESPN LA. All right, Mason in Ireland is here. I like it when it's Momo in Ireland. I don't know what Morales is talking about. But the question for many of us who love the NBA is, when's it going to start? The owners, it came out that at a Board of Governors meeting, are talking about maybe trying to start on December 22nd. The reason they would do that is that it would be more lucrative. Here's Brian Windhorst last night on SportsCenter talking about how there's more money for everyone if they start around Christmas.
Yeah, and talking to some ownership sources today, one of the things the owners made clear is, look, there's a certain pile of money that is available if you start as a players union on December 22nd. And then there's another pile of money if you want to start on Martin Luther King weekend in mid-January. And there's a big difference between those two piles. And, you know, they want to start in December, but they want the players to realize that there's not any way to get that money back if they wait. And because of that reality, because money is a factor here, I do think that eventually the players are going to come to an agreement.
You agree, Ramona? Are we playing at Christmas?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we'll just they'll have to work something out with some of the star players, especially the guys who play deep into October. Say, okay, I know you're going to need some time to ramp up here. You didn't get that long of a break. So we're not going to, you know, crack down hard on the load management, but try and show up for the Christmas Day game, right? You know, the worst thing they can do is restart and then have none of the star guys play on Christmas. That would be tough. But I think,
well,
most,
you know, that's funny you should bring that up. Windhorse was asked, what happens if LeBron and the other star players don't want to play at Christmas? Here's what he said.
Nobody wants it to come to that. And in the past, even when LeBron has been upset about things, it hasn't come to that. But here's the reality. The reality is the overwhelming majority of players haven't played since September 1st. Eight different teams haven't played since March. So the overwhelming players, the rank and file, are going to want to play earlier. It's just a matter of getting those teams who are in the playoffs late, which are the teams they want to start on Christmas, to come to an understanding that it needs to be for the greater good. And it's going to be a process, but I think it's going to get there.
And it's interesting, Rona, you know, the Lakers have a coaching staff and have a medical staff, a training staff, that I think they would figure out a way to make it work. They're kind of cutting edge in that regard. And I think that, like you said earlier, you may not see guys playing major minutes early, but I think that they would figure out a way if the league says, hey, we really, really need to start at Christmas. Maybe we do get a chance to see Talen Horton Tucker more, or we do get a chance to see Alex Caruso more. But it's going to be fast. Think about it. Draft in 3 weeks, free agency right after the draft, training camps right after that, start on Christmas. That's quick.
Does anybody care about what we in the media are feeling, which is burnt out?
No,
gosh, dang. Like, I mean, it just feels like we just got done with this. I need a little break here, like a little off season, you know? I mean, we never really get one because it always goes straight from the finals to the draft to free agency. But there's usually like a good month and a half where things are quiet.
Not anymore. But no. I actually like the idea of, like what you were talking about earlier, of getting back on the calendar.
Yeah.
Because all the research indicates that the more you go into summer, the more the ratings go down. Also, it seems like if you're having your championship up against regular season NFL football, you're going to have trouble pulling numbers. So I think that I'd love to see the NBA kind of owns June, May and June.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see them get back to that where they could own May and June.
Yeah. And the other one, and this is, I think this has receded from being top of mind, but it is still a consideration, is the Olympics, which are supposed to begin in late July. Okay.
But do the players want that, or do the owners?
Want to play in the Olympics.
Explain to me why that's important to them.
So there's a few players who have never really gotten to do the Olympic thing. I think Steph Curry hasn't. I know it's a really big platform for a lot of the big stars to go win a title for their country. And, you know, they didn't all turn out, of course, for the World Championships, and we finished sixth or whatever we finished. But I think that the NBA would like to leave the door open for some of its star players to be able to play in the Olympics. And that means being done on a normal calendar. Like, you could probably go a little bit into July, but you've got to give them a couple of weeks in between. And that's what we're talking about, getting back on the normal calendar.
Okay, coming up next is Game of Games. I locked up October yesterday, which means the clock starts on November a day early. Officially, we don't have a November show until Monday, but we're going to start it today. I have a game. Ramona, Lindsay, and Jorge will compete in this game. All I will tell you is that it is Halloween themed.
Ooh.
And we will do it next. Game of Games, Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
All right, Game of Games is here. This is the first game that will count towards November, even though it's October 30th. It's my game, so either Ramona, Lindsay, or Jorge will have the lead going into the actual first day of November. Now, here's the game, guys. Tomorrow night is Halloween. I have a list of Halloween facts. Excellent music, Jorge. You guys simply tell me true or false. Here we go. Fact number one. Although Halloween has been around forever, the tradition of trick-or-treating is less than 100 years old. It started in the military during World War II when the young children of soldiers would dress up in costumes and perform tricks in an attempt to cheer up their fathers. It morphed into all kinds of kids doing it, and now you don't even have to do tricks. You just get a treat. Lindsay, is that story true or false?
I'm going to go with false.
Okay. Jorge.
Man, this sounds too good. I'm going to go with false as well.
You're going false. Okay.
Yeah. I think it's false too.
All three of you are correct. Trick-or-treating has existed since medieval times. Back then, it was known as guising. Wow. In Scotland and Ireland, young people dressed up in costumes and asked for food or money in exchange for songs, poems, or other tricks. So everybody is on the board. Fact number two. The most popular Halloween costume of all time is a simple one. A ghost. Amazon reports that they sell an average of 3 million ghost-related costumes annually, making it the most popular costume by a margin of 2-1. Jorge, is that true or false?
I'm going to say true.
All right, Ramona.
I'm going to say false. I think it's a witch.
Okay, Lindsay.
I think it's false, too.
Lindsay and Ramona are right, and Ramona, you are 100% correct.
Yes.
Witch is the most popular, with over 4.6 million people planning to dress up as a witch this year alone. All right. So the girls take the lead, Jorge trailing by one. Fact number three. Some Halloween rituals used to involve finding a husband. During the 18th century, ladies would follow Halloween traditions that would help them find a romantic match. Women would throw apple peels over their shoulder to see their future husband's initials, competitively bob for apples at parties, because the winner would be the first to get married. Ramona, is that true or did I just make it up?
I think that's true.
All right, Lindsay.
I'm going to go false.
Jorge, break the tie.
No, man, I'm going to go false as well.
Ramona is the winner, and she's 3-for-3. That is 100% true. Okay, number four. We have seven of these, by the way.
All right.
All right. Number four, it's back to Lindsay. The Michael Myers mask in the movie Halloween is really a mask of William Shatner spray-painted white. The production designer on the movie went to a Hollywood magic store and came back to the set with two masks. One of a clown, and one of Captain Kirk. The producers thought the Captain Kirk mask looked scary, so they painted it white, and the rest is history. Lindsay, true or false?
True.
True. Jorge?
That is true.
Ramona?
I am also going to say true.
It is 100% true. Lindsay, it sounds like you've heard that story before.
Yeah, that was all over Yahoo last week.
It is true. So Lindsay, 3. Ramona, 4. Jorge, 2. All right, fact number five. Illinois produces up to 5 times more pumpkins than any other state. It has more than 15,000 acres devoted to gourd growing, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Those Illinois farms typically grow more than 500 million pounds of pumpkins annually. Jorge, true or false? Is Illinois the pumpkin capital of America?
I'm going to say false.
All right, Ramona.
I'm going to say false as well.
All right, Lindsay.
I'm going to go opposite and say true.
You're glad you did, Lindsay. Ramona, that's your first miss. 100% true. All right, so it's Lindsay 4, Jorge 2, and Ramona 4.
Dang,
Jorge, you need these two to tie force a tiebreaker, all right? Jorge, I'll let you go last on each of these since you're behind. All right. Strangely, Halloween brings with it a full moon. This year will be the 5th full moon of this century, the last one occurring in 2017. Ramona, is that true or false?
Well, it's definitely a full moon. I know all of my astrology people are really into this one. But I don't know if it's the fifth one of this century, but I am going to say false. I think it's like probably more than that.
Okay. Ramona's going false. Lindsay.
Do you mean the fifth full moon on Halloween this century?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I'll say true.
Okay. Jorge.
I'm going to go with true.
It's false. And Ramona gets the point. This year will be the first Halloween in 19 years to have a full moon.
Whoa.
Full moons on Halloween are pretty rare, actually.
I'll buy it.
The last time there was a full moon on October 31st was 2001, and before that was 1955. The next one won't occur until 2039. All right. So we got one left. Ramona, 5. Lindsay, 4. Jorge, you're out of it. All right. It means Ramona has to go first.
It'll give
Lindsay a chance to go the other way if she wants. Ramona, this is the seventh and final Halloween fact. The Irish are responsible for jack-o'-lanterns. As the story goes, an Irish man named Stingy Jack tricked tricked the devil and therefore was not allowed into heaven or hell. So he spent his days roaming the earth carrying a lantern, and he went by Jack of the Lantern. Ramona, is that true or false?
That sounds so crazy. I am going to say true because you were laughing to throw me off, and I think it's actually true.
Okay, Lindsay.
I think it's true, too. I know I can't win.
Yeah. But so you're going true?
That's why you should let the person who's not ahead go first.
Well, the question, the answer is it is true. So Ramona wins anyway. Well, the reason, Lindsay, we let you go second is because then Ramona would just pick what you pick and she wins.
Right.
So that's why you get to go second so you can go the other way. If not, Ramona could just pick whatever you picked and it's over. All right. We'll do the tiebreaker just for fun.
Okay.
Jorge, you can be in this one. According to the National Retail Foundation, how much does the average family of four spend on Halloween each year? Closest without going over. So average family of four, Lindsay, how much do they spend on Halloween each year? So this includes costumes, candies, decorations, whatever you want to throw in there. How much?
$250.
Okay. Jorge.
I'll say $550.
Okay, Ramona.
I am going to say, so closest without going over, right?
Right.
So I will say $1.
Ramona wins easily. You guys were way high. $86.27.
There we go.
$86.27.
Once you buy your decorations, you don't have to buy them all new.
Yeah, but you said costumes and everything. My 9-year-old nephew's costume alone was like $60.
Yeah, but so, okay, let's say that's 60. And let's say your sister, it's your sister's son, right?
Yes.
She buys candy. Does she buy more?
Like $10 itself, just for one pack.
Okay, so now you're at 70. And so if she goes and buys $16 more worth of candy, there's your $86. Where'd you get to $250?
Well, I mean, between her husband, and my nephew all dressing up for Halloween, three people's costumes, candy for the whole, neighborhood, whatever, and they go all out with decorations.
So are they trick-or-treating in Ohio?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think there's going to be a lot of it here. I think most people are not going to
trick-or-treat. I think most states are allowing trick-or-treat, more like the only one who's not.
Yeah, it just seems like the fastest way to spread the virus. Like, let's go door-to-door with them.
but if you're wearing masks,
what matters?
If everyone's wearing masks, and my sister said they're going to put the candy out in the garage and let it sit there for a couple of days before he eats it. So, to me, that's fine.
All right. A reminder that all Game of Games is proudly presented by Buffalo Wild Wings and the all-new Champ Sauce. Champ Sauce is rolling out just for you, L.A. Perfect combo of sweet and heat. Try it at Buffalo Wild Wings or order from the Buffalo Wild Wings app today. Coming up next, a little purgatory, a little crosstalk. Sedano, I think, is back. If not, we may get Scott Kapp. Lindsay, do you know?
I think Sedano's back.
All right, so it'll be George and LZ coming up next. Mason and Ireland, ESPN.
Hi, it's Mike Greenberg letting you know ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sportsbook of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me, plus many more. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today. New users get a bet reset up to $1,000 in bonus bets if your first bet doesn't win. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
The interesting thing about yesterday's purgatory was that LZ's movers, he's in the middle of a move, had taken his router out despite the fact that he had told them and written down, do not take my router out. So he had to come into the studio. I know we have George. George, do you know if you have LZ today?
I have not heard from LZ in a couple of hours. I went and called him at our normal 3:30 call time to discuss the show and did not hear from him today, which is strange. And usually he'll at least text me back and say, hey, I'm in the middle of something. I'll get back to you. But that happened 2 days ago as well. It's why I did Purgatory with you alone the other day,
right?
Because of that. So yeah, the movers have caused him a lot of consternation. And for Morales, I know you love Cap so much. So do I. I used to intern for the guy back in 1999. So I love the guy, and he'll be on with me on Monday and Tuesday because LZ is going to be doing adult things, you know, like covering an election.
Oh, right.
Oh, that's right. LZ is those are going to be a big couple of days for him. So George, since you, Ramona, and I are all, and so is LZ, in the league,
no Mason today, no worried about these outsiders. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think happens with the start date? When do we see NBA basketball regular season games, in your opinion?
If I had to bet, I would say December 22nd. And the reason I say that is this. I think that ultimately the players are going to want to get as close to their real salary as possible.
Yep.
And if you play 50 games, that is not going to happen. Also, the players are going to want to play in the Olympics, at least the top, 15, 20 guys, whatever.
Explain why to me.
What do you mean?
Why do they want to play in the Olympics? I have always felt like that most – first
branding.
Of all, most of the guys on our Olympic team have already played in the Olympics. Like,
but it's branding.
Do you think LeBron plays again?
I don't know if LeBron plays again, but it is branding. I think that helps those guys overseas. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, look, I'm not discounting the part of representing your country, but I do think that there is a capitalistic part of this, and I don't blame anyone for that. So I think that the branding matters. And yeah, there's no way you're going to be ready to play in the Olympics if you start in January and you want to have as close to a full season as possible. So I just think it comes down to that. And I look, this is a negotiation. So that means there'll be a concession somewhere.
By the way, are you both convinced we'll have an Olympics?
Yeah, I am.
Why?
I think that they can bubble things pretty well.
Will there be fans?
That I'm not convinced of. I know a lot of teams and places that are investing heavily into testing, into research and how they can have fans and testing and that, do a rapid test for everyone who comes in. But I think the safest way to keep all the athletes safe would be to, we're having an Olympic Village. Everybody gets tested all the time. Like, there's already a way of sequestering them. Maybe we'll have limited fans. Maybe we'll have a quarter capacity. But I think the Olympics are going to happen. I think they're going to have to sort of bubble things off and test everybody and do what we've been doing in most sports.
Well, and let's face it, and I know that all this kind of comes in waves and whatnot, right? But it feels like the Asian countries have done a much better job of this.
Taiwan has no coronavirus, George.
Right. Well, they also had the experience of MERS and SARS, and they learned from that experience, particularly with the contact tracing. So you're right. I think that in that regard, I think that will be better. And I do think, to Momo's point, it's actually the easiest place to do a bubble, right?
Yeah. All right, George, I have breaking news.
Okay.
I think
LZ's here, too, by the way.
We have located LZ Grandison.
Yeah.
That's my breaking news.
Yeah, LZ, thanks for picking up the phone call at 3:30 like we always do. Thanks. Appreciate it.
You're very, very welcome. Yeah. Actually, it's only by the grace of God I'm actually on air right now. Lots of drama. I won't spoil you with the details, rather.
Well, I mean, just give us a little quick summary.
LZ, what is give us the short version. Where are you located? Are you in your home or are you at the station?
I'm finally back in Scottsdale.
Okay.
I was tumultuous travel, but I'm still consumed with the fact that we hired quite possibly the worst moving people to ever move.
I feel like everybody always says this. Yeah. After they've
no,
done
no, no, but LZ, I actually sympathize with you. Moving is the worst.
It is worse. The worst.
It is the worst. I do feel you guys are right. Everyone says it, but I'm pretty sure it shouldn't take a week to move an apartment that's less than 1,000 square feet.
That is true, especially yeah. not even out of the time zone.
Well, but you know what happens with movers, LZ, is that they, on their way to Arizona, for example, they're picking up like three or four other people, and your stuff is getting loaded in this big container.
Wait, LZ, I want you to walk up to those movers and look them right in the eye and say you're listening to KSPN Los Angeles.
Stole a tip.
If I walked up to those movers, you might have to call the popo. Get the bail money ready.
You've had it.
I'll just give you one example of some of the things I've been trying to deal with. I love sneakers. Mm-hmm. I have like maybe, I don't know, north of 100 sneakers, right?
You got a long way to go to catch P.J. Tucker.
P.J. Tucker of the Rockets.
Yeah. Well, he makes a little bit more money than I do.
He does, yes.
But they're all in shoe boxes, right? Nice, clear shoe boxes you get from the container store. And my movers thought it was a good idea to take all the shoes out of the shoe boxes.
Oh, no.
Put them in a separate box, pack the shoe boxes separately by themselves.
Oh, come on.
But before they do that, they took all of the doors off of the shoe boxes because they didn't want them to flap around.
So you've lost the boxes now.
So everything's like an absolute complete mess. I was trying to, like, I couldn't find my phone at one point, George. So I know you were calling. I just didn't know where my phone was because the house is a complete and utter mess right now.
Well, LZ, I actually do have some relatively bad news. You're in Scottsdale now?
Yes, sir.
You realize that of all the places Steve Mason could go on vacation, he's decided to go to Scottsdale.
Oh, my God.
So he'll be descending on you at some point this weekend. I won't tell him you're there.
It's quite all right. Scottsdale is a large piece of land.
Yeah.
I have all types of people here that I know that I have yet to see since April. So I can add Steve to that list.
So how is it that you're living in Scottsdale?
Well, because you can work from home.
Yeah. But is this like a permanent thing? Is this like a...
Oh, so hubby is like a big exec with PetSmart, which is based in Scottsdale.
Got it.
And so the plan was, is like, well, it's not that far apart. Right, it's like an hour flight, so it's not that big of a deal. We're adults, we can manage it. You know, it's like, am I thrilled not to see my hubby Monday through Friday? Well, of course not, but I always like to compare my struggles with real struggles, and then that makes my struggles so much smaller.
That's right.
Hey, I wanted to throw something at you guys. We did a really serious story on the show today that I honestly don't know how to feel about it. I don't. I'm being genuine. Matter of fact, LZ, you mentioned you're in Scottsdale. This is a story about the Arizona Coyotes, the hockey team. They drafted a guy who, as it turns out, when he was in junior high school, all right, so he was in eighth grade. He was 13.
I thought he was older than that.
He was 13 when he did it. Okay. He bullied a young African-American special needs kid in junior high. So it's a little ugly. He, him and another kid talked this special needs kid into eating candy that had been placed in a urinal, and they physically assaulted him, and they got caught. And they were sentenced to community service, and it's obviously a horrible look on these kids' records, but it was in junior high school. Now, you guys all know that I'm a father of a special needs kid, so my blood boiled extra when I read this, but he was drafted in the first round by the Arizona Coyotes. And last night, the Arizona Coyotes, after a huge backlash from the community, relinquished his rights. They basically cut him. Even though they knew when they drafted him that this had happened, the kid had written a letter to every team explaining what had happened and apologizing for it. But they just realized they didn't want to take the heat. LZ, I'll start with you. I'm not sure that canceling a kid for something he did when he was 13 is the way we want to move forward in society. But on the other hand, I'm the father of a special needs kid, and I'm furious at the guy. What's the right way to handle this?
Oh, man. What is the right way? I don't think there's going to be an answer that's satisfactory for everyone. So
I agree.
It's really about...
What would you do, I guess, would be the...
What would
the
I do? I would have never have drafted him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have drafted him in the
By the way,
place.
For context, George, he is now... plays hockey for the University of North Dakota on scholarship. North Dakota knew about it, knew about the incident, and they figured that they would give this kid a second chance and to give him some structure and hope he would straighten out. I don't think it hurts that he's a really, really good hockey player. Well, Sedano, when I describe that story, what do you think the way to handle this is?
Man, I'm with LZ. Like, this is a really tough situation. Normally, I am... of the opinion to say, like, hey, you know, you shouldn't hold somebody accountable for something they did when they were a child, literally a child. And look, I talk about this stuff all the time in context, right? Like, I don't love cancel culture. And the reason I say that is, like, I'll give you an example. A year or two ago, I tweeted out, oh, Eddie Murphy Raw is on television. I'm going to watch it. And I got a lot of responses.
Right, because about, it doesn't hold up. It's very offensive in 2020.
Very offensive on a lot of yeah. stuff. And I said, and my response to the couple of people that brought it up, I said, listen, I totally understand that. I was working on the morning show with LZ, and I actually said, I understand, you know, that a lot of the things he said about the LGBT community is highly offensive, but I can't apply 2020 sensibilities to 1987. You know what I mean? Like, sure. And by the way, he had since apologized, I believe, at that point, whenever this was. So, I just kind of laid it out like that, and I think this
you
is
know, George.
What's
not
that?
Not to cut you off, but I did. Burn the Life and Keyshawn.
Yeah.
The thing is, he never apologized to the family or the kid that he bullied.
Right. Okay. So that was going to be my point, was that the difference here between these two situations is that, right? And I think had he just done that, and by the way, that's kind of on his family too. Like, just do that. Help yourself, help your kid learn from this experience, right? Because look, we're all going to make mistakes. Some of us bigger mistakes than others. And I think as parents, and we're all parents here on this panel here, and I think that that's kind of the deal, right? You know your kids are going to make mistakes. Hopefully they're not mistakes that cause them potentially their future. But no matter what the mistake is, you have to have them learn from those mistakes and right the wrong in any way they can.
Yeah, for me, the tipping point on this one was the family of the special needs kid did not feel like he had atoned for it. They said he never really sent that letter to him, or they never got it. He never called. They never
felt
like
Well, Ramona, you pointed out that there were two kids that bullied the special needs kid, and the one kid went over the top in apologizing, reached out to the kid, you know, made sure that he did everything he could to make it right, and the hockey player did not.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I would have never drafted him because it wasn't simply, not that there's, you know, tears to this conversation, but it wasn't simply a bullying thing, right? Like, this was beyond bullying. He was hit with racist taunts from these young men.
That's right.
In addition to, you know, the candy and what they did with it. So I would have never drafted him because you're right. No one wants to be judged by their worst moment, but there still must be judgment for your worst moment, whether you want it to
but
happen
LZ,
or not.
Does it matter that he's 13 when it happened?
There are young men right now in juvenile, in prison in some cases, for things they did at 13.
Okay. Yeah, Ramona made that point earlier. She felt 13 was a more fully formed adult than I was giving it credit for.
Well, yeah. I wouldn't say it's an adult. In fact, I think our system in which we imprison young people for long periods of time like that is flawed, but that's the system that we have. And so until there's a more systematic sort of correction of this, I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, well, we shouldn't judge him for being racist and beating up a special needs kid because he was just a kid, when there are young people in jail who weren't racist, who were accused of things they may not even have done, but they're in juvie or sometimes they're in an adult prison.
Yeah, look, I just think ultimately to put a kind of wrap this part of it up, like just, yeah, man, like just you got to teach your kids. And again, that's why I said it's on the parent, right? Like, you got to teach your kids, don't be a jerk, right? Like, just big picture, right?
Fair
like,
enough.
Don't be a jerk. Racist.
Well, no, agreed. But let's just say it wasn't a black kid. If it was a white kid with disabilities, There's no need to be a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, that's just it. There's no need to be a jerk.
Hey, let me end it on something lighter. What do you guys think of the White Sox hiring 76-year-old Tony La Russa to coach a young team that is, a lot of people feel, is playoff ready next year? George, I'll start with you. Is it smart bringing in kind of a Yoda-like figure, or is this have disaster written all over it?
Okay, so I can tell you that I covered a team in 2003 with the Florida Marlins, okay, that had a manager in Jeff Torborg. They fired him like whatever it was, 30 games into the season, and they brought in Jack McKeon.
I knew that. Jack was living in San Diego at the time. I used to golf with him. I remember this.
Who was 70-something years old at that time,
73,
right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and everyone made a mockery of it, and they won the World Series. So, based on that, just living through that, I'm not going to mock this like some people are. Do I think there were plenty of other candidates who were more who would have made more sense? Yes. It seemed like they fired Rick Renteria, my Hispanic brother, because he wasn't analytically prone, right? Like, he wasn't into analytics. So you bring in La Russa? Like, how is he analytically inclined? Like, that part I don't get, but I did hear Bill Shaken with you guys earlier talk about that this is about Reinsdorf wanting to right a wrong because he feels like he shouldn't ever let go of La Russa back in the 80s or whatever the hell it was. I mean, whatever, I guess. I mean, it's his team. He can do whatever the hell he wants. But I don't want to mock it because I've seen crazier things happen and work out. But I do feel like if I'm Rick Renteria, I'm pretty pissed off.
LZ, you think there's more of a chance it works or it doesn't work?
I mean, listen, I thought the hiring was trash. Not that La Russa's trash, but the hiring and the process of the hiring was straight trash. I mean, seriously, Dave Roberts is still, what, the only African-American manager? There's only like six total minority managers in a league that's dominated by Latinos. Come on. What are we doing?
Yeah, 35% of the of the players are Latino, and only like – and you just fired one. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just fired Rick Renteria, who made the playoffs, didn't he?
Yep.
So, what the hell?
So, I'm not going to poo-poo La Russa or talk about the age.
No, he's super accomplished,
but
obviously.
But the process of hiring managers in baseball.
Right, he is. How does that work? Do we take him out of the Hall of Fame?
I don't think so. I think he gets to stay in. All right, so, George,
he should have to wait 5 more years. Get him out and put him back in.
Why not? George, what else you got coming up today?
What do we got today? We've got DeMarco's going to stop by. We'll talk some Rams. We got a lot of NFL on the show today. Plus, we've got some fun stuff we're going to do today. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to do our Halloween candy snake draft. Okay.
All right.
We're going to do that. We're going to do the scariest players to face in the NFL and the scariest players to face in the NBA. So we're going to have some fun today.